calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Today is AIDS Day, International AIDS Day. HIV, one of the biggest social, economic, and health challenges in the world, a global emergency claiming over 8,000 lives a day. Five people will die of AIDS every minute. 40.3 million people estimated around the world living with HIV and AIDS. New age HIV cases just in this last year, 4.9 million. So just a heads up, something to pay attention to. Also on this day in history, Rosa Parks said, "No, I am not going to give up my seat to a white man and move to the back of the bus," thus arguably sparking the modern civil rights movement and bringing about major changes in the face and nature of the United States. And we remember her on this day. Jan Brook is with us with the Ayn Rand Group, AynRand.org, the Ayn Rand Institute. And one of the reasons I probably shouldn't do this introduction every time because our regular listeners know what it's all about, but I really still think it's important to say. Ayn Rand and her book The Fountainhead, and in particular Atlas Shrugged and her defense of selfishness. What was the title of that? The
pamphlet? It was a book called The Virtue of Selfishness.
The Virtue of Selfishness. Thank you very much. That one and Atlas Shrugged in particular have become the philosophical core of, became the philosophical core of objectivism, which you're still carrying the banner for. And that, in some ways, has morphed into libertarianism, although I realize you wouldn't characterize yourself as libertarian, but the Cato Institute, you know, is carrying on that. And that, in many ways, has morphed into the modern-day conservative movement. And I think that if people want to know the true philosophical underpinnings of the modern-day conservative movement, or some good chunk of it, that they really should go to AynRand.org and read the essays and read your writings for that matter. Jaron Brook, the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. I'm so pleased that you come on regularly and talk with us because you're one of the few guys who just honestly tells us, you know, what you think rather than all these nonsense talking points. And this is my problem with the Republicans. They believe a lot of the same things you do, but they're afraid to say it. And you actually come out and say it.
Well, you know, I think unfortunately they don't. I mean, it's people like Bill Frist, the conservatives who bring CEOs of oil companies, subpoena them, bring them in front. I mean, you know my position on the oil company CEOs. I would never do that and would never advocate for that.
So right, you think that they should simply be allowed to,
in my view.
Yeah, they should simply be allowed to do whatever they want, and what business do we have of subpoenaing them? And yeah, okay. Now, in fact, along those lines, these recent articles that I don't know if you wrote this or if you just passed it along to us, but that Merck has laid off now 8,000 employees, and you suggest that, in a word, it is caused by FDA incompetence, regulations, and capricious lawsuits. Give us your wrap on that.
Well, I think generally the drug industry in the United States is suffering. Stocks of the major drug companies are down about 50% over the last year or so. And I think this is a consequence of the massive regulatory burden that they're under, the massive political pressure that they're under to lower drug prices, and the fact that the FDA is so slow to approve so many drugs and then so quick to pull drugs off the counter, irrespective of the good they do some people. Instead of leaving it up to physicians and their patients to make the best decision for a particular individual, the FDA chooses to make global decisions for everybody in the name of the public good, in spite of the fact that some people die because they can't get medication that would help them.
Okay, and so you made several points there, Jaron, and let's just go through them one at a time. First of all, you said that the pharmaceutical industry is struggling under massive regulation. I'm assuming that you know that the pharmaceutical industry actually asks for an awful lot of the regulations under which they operate, because those regulations not only circumscribe and in some ways define the boundaries of their behavior, but more importantly, protect them from an awful lot of liability, because they can say, hey, we're operating within the regulations, therefore you can't sue us, what we did was legal.
Well, I think that's partially true. I think the liability law in this country is out of control, just generally. But there's no question, businessmen are often their worst enemies, their own worst enemies, in that they often ask for regulations, sometimes in order to impede competition, sometimes in order to protect themselves, sometimes they engage in you know, bribing congressmen and senators in order to get their way. That is very unfortunate. It's unfortunate that politicians have so much power over the functioning of business that business has to feel like it needs to protect itself by doing these things.
So, for example,
I'm not going to defend regulations because business asked for them. These regulations get thrown out.
Yeah. So for example, when Monsanto went to George Herbert Walker Bush back when he was vice president in the Reagan administration, and asked him specifically if he would start regulating genetically modified organisms, and there were none on the market. And they asked him if he would do that, and the reason, of course, why was because they wanted to bring them to the market, and they wanted to have some legal protection. And he went ahead and did that, and that paved the way for it. You think that shouldn't have even been a discussion that was had, that Monsanto simply should have been able to bring these genetically modified organisms onto the market, and that there shouldn't even have been a government agency that would have been chartered with regulating them.
I think that's right. I think these they should have been allowed to bring these onto market, and if harm could have been proved, then that's why we have a court system to compensate those that have been harmed and to prevent Monsanto from continuing.
But here's where I think your argument is breaking down, Yaron, is you're suggesting that, and correctly so, that we have a court system to remedy past harms. But the purpose of a regulatory system is to prevent future harms. I mean, for example, you're suggesting that the Merck's problem with Vioxx is not that they made a product that kills people, but rather that they were overregulated and that they're being overly lawsuited, right?
Well, I think there are multiple problems with it. What we've created in the United States is a population that takes drugs, once the FDA has approved the drug, assumes that the drug is safe, and then just takes it for whatever. They don't really, doctors are not doing their function as consulting patients on an individual basis and what drugs are appropriate or not. We have just shifted the responsibility as a culture to the FDA, to the government to take care of us, rather than the case in Vioxx is that some people, Vioxx is not good for, people with heart disease or potential for heart disease. Other people, Vioxx is almost a lifesaver. It's the only pain medication that helps them, and they're at a low-risk group for heart disease.
But again,
what the FDA does is it's a global statement.
Now, I understand that, but you've raised two points here. The first is that, you know, the doctors should be the guys who are figuring this out for us. But I can't use the word libertarian, in your laissez-faire economic world, the doctor would be primarily interested in making the most money, which would mean he'd be seeing the fewest number of patients. But
well, that's not true. I mean, the fact is that the doctor would be interested in providing you with the best service and the best health, just like any service provider, so that he could increase the amount he charges to you or increase the number
but
of
how do we,
that he sees.
I like understand. How do we protect ourselves from predators, though? Here, for example, the Wall Street Journal reported that emails seen by the paper show that Merck executives, I'm quoting from the Wall Street Journal, show that Merck executives were worried in the mid to late 1990s. Now, that's 7, 8, 9 years ago, that Vioxx had greater heart risk than cheaper painkillers. The paper said several company officials discussed in emails how to design a study that would minimize the finding that Vioxx caused heart attacks. In March of 2000, Merck chief researcher Edward Schalnick stated the cardiovascular events are clearly there, called it a shame, and yet Merck covered this up. You have no problem with that?
No, of course I have a problem. If people are committing criminal activities, if people are defrauding, if they're lying, then that needs to be prosecuted.
So they brought this product to market.
The role of government is not to be preventive. The role of government is to protect our individual rights.
So then we shouldn't do anything about this until 100,000 people or more have died and we have redress to the courts? Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is that people are dying because the FDA won't allow these drugs onto the market, and therefore people who are on the verge of death can't get drugs. People who are suffering now because they don't have painkillers, can't get Vioxx. I'm saying that the harm caused by regulation far exceeds the risk that you would take on by leaving the market alone.
You know, I got to say, Yaron, if we lived in communities of 100 people or so, I mean, I lived in a small town in Montpelier. We had a lousy doctor. Everybody knew it. He eventually got run out of business because he was a lousy doctor. Mm-hmm. But if he had moved to New York City, he could have simply moved from neighborhood to neighborhood and made a good living for the rest of his life, maiming people.
Well, you know, I don't think that's true. I think that what happens very quickly in a true market is that bad doctors get labeled as bad doctors. Rating agencies rate doctors just like they rate hospitals today. And you can easily find the good doctors, the good hospitals, and the bad ones and get rid of them.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting debate. Thank you for having it with me. I appreciate it. Great to have you on. Yaron Brook, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, the website. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour here, where our reason is our lifestyle choice.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I got upon a train one day, went to work in my usual way, got some coffee, went to my desk. Suddenly I had this pain in my chest. Oh no, I said, the boss must be coming. Now the boss walks in, sets herself down, gives what she thinks is a thoughtful frown. She says, we're in a slump, you know, and as a result, you've got to go.
Uh-oh.
You have been downsized. I said, ouch. So as a result of this management stunt, I was unemployed for a couple of months. Found myself another job, nose to the grindstone, worked like a dog. Then they said, we've got too much workforce. We got to have a release of resources. This means you. That meant me. So I found myself a crappier job.
And on it goes, on it goes. Welcome back, 22 minutes past the hour. Just Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Eco Wine, the organic wine company, 1-888-ECOWINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE, for extraordinary organic French wines. Check them out. Just as a heads up, in the next hour, Congressman Ron Paul is going to be with us. One of the few Republicans in the House of Representatives who tells it like it is, at least from his point of view, who strongly defends his positions, who is willing to come on a program like this, and who is suggesting and is very concerned that the Bush administration is preparing to militarize America with foreign troops. This is from the United States Congressman. He'll be on in the next hour. And Jeremy Scahill, a reporter for The Nation, asking, does Al Jazeera really deserve a bomb? What's that all about? Clara Jeffrey's going to be with us from Mother Jones Magazine in the third hour of the program. Who gives a flying leap about charities? To what extent, really, should we be saying, you know, everybody ought to give to this? I mean, should we be gathering money for Katrina, for example? Or should the government be doing something about that? Should we be collectively doing it ourselves? Where are the boundaries? Where are the appropriate boundary lines? And how do we as a society decide that? Good stuff. America's loss is turning out to be India's gain. This from a newspaper in New Delhi. This is not getting much coverage in the American press, but you heard it here first. Within days of announcing 30,000 job cuts in the United States, automobile giant General Motors Company this week will unveil plans to increase its workforce in India by nearly 30%. A senior headhunter at the time told the Times of India, GM is going on a hiring spree in India, and it's adding jobs on the factory shop floor as well as the executive cadre. GM will this week start the process of hiring additional people for its India venture. This is in line, so the source said, with the company's plans to expand its presence in India, which GM feels will drive future growth. I've said it before, I've got to say it again. Saying to people, you know, how dare you not drive an American car, for example, as a caller said to me the other day, shame is not a national industrial policy. Shaming consumers is not a national industrial policy. We need a national industrial policy in the United States, or what we're going to end up with, and we're already halfway there, if not more, is a handful, a relative handful, 400, 500, 600, 700 huge multinational corporations whose interest is in profit, not the United States, and who are willing to sell out the middle class or the working class of the United States for profits. And you know, will the middle class ever come back? Will it ever return? Good question. I mean, it's just, this is, well, should we be surprised? I mean, really, should we be surprised? That and oh boy, I got a conservative alert here for you. I got to tell you, the Bush administration, this is in the Daily Star, commentary by William Fisher. Bush administration has taken promotion to embarrassing extremes in the past. Brownie, you're doing a great job, doing a heck of a job. Harriet Myers, let's put her on the Supreme Court. Now they have announced the appointment of Paul Bonicelli to be the Deputy Director of the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. Now, here's why this is something that really all of America should be slapping their forehead going, what? First of all, what is USAID? The Agency for International Development has a long and checkered past. It has, for many years, been both a major foreign aid arm of the U.S. government and a major propaganda arm of the United States government. The agency for, and people have alleged over the years that it's affiliated with the CIA. I'd say, you know, it may be, it's probably more likely that they're simply all working in the same direction, which is to advance the interests of the United States to the extent that it can be done outside the United States. So here now we have Bonicelli. No experience in international development. He is, however, the Dean of Academic Affairs at Patrick Henry College, a college in rural Virginia that was started 5 years ago for Christian homeschooled students. And their motto is For Christ and Liberty. And in order to be a student there, you must sign a statement of faith, a student or a faculty member, saying that hell is a place where all who die outside of Christ shall be confined in conscious torment for eternity. So now, first of all, let me say, you know, Christians want to believe, there are many Christians who believe that. I happen not to be one of them, but there are many Christians who believe that. And I'm not going to say that they shouldn't be able to believe that, but here's a guy who is promoting this notion that if you are not Christian, you will go to hell, period, end of discussion. And the USAID is responsible for our efforts in the Middle East to promote the interests of the United States. It is the agency that's funding Karen Hughes. Karen Hughes is going over there having these conversations with Muslim folks. The USAID is the program, is the agency that is supposed to be building bridges with the Islamic world. And George W. Bush has just appointed to be the number two guy in USAID, a guy who says, if you're not Christian, you're toast. I wonder how the Muslims are going to feel about that. 27 minutes past.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I've been eliminated, repositioned, been told my career is in transition, right-sized, reshaped, reduced, released, and every time, my pay's decreased. So I asked the big shot, why can't we raise the pitiful, paltry minimum wage? Come on, he said, now use your head. More folks will lose their jobs, he said. I work hard, my raise helps the nation, but a raise for you only causes inflation. Union PACs want to buy the election, but corporate PACs promote free expression. Folks on welfare are parasites, but corporate welfare makes the economy bright. A job is good. A job is fine. But layoffs are good for the bottom line. Yeah. Well, that just about covers it.
Janice Lever, thank you very much. Welcome back. 34 minutes before the hour, or after the hour, 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman, we're here with you. Just a few more things here on this administration. Paul Bonicelli, the Deputy Director of the United States Agency for International Development, the latest appointment by the Bush administration. He is the Dean of Academic Affairs, as mentioned, at Tiny Patrick Henry College in rural Virginia. The fundamentalist institution's motto is For Christ and Liberty. Again, I have no problem with that if that's what he wants to do. I just, you know, I'm a little concerned that this guy has been put in charge of speaking to the Muslim world. Faculty members must sign a pledge stating that they share a literalist belief in the Bible. Biology and theology teachers are required to hold a literal view specifically of the Bible's six-day creation story. And Bonicelli himself has said, I believe in six literal days. In other words, he thinks that the entire universe came into being in six 24-hour periods. And he now is, many Patrick Henry students, by the way, have been chosen to serve as interns working for White House political advisor Karl Rove. Says Bonicelli, most students' values don't link up with those of the Democrats. It's amazing. Their values link up with Karl Rove? I mean, that's a little spooky, I got to say. That's a lot spooky, in fact. So, you know, this is just, I don't know how to say it beyond. It's just absolutely tragic. Senator John Warner, the Republican from Virginia, yesterday on CNN, essentially came out and said, looks to me, I'm not quoting him, this is the essence of what he said, I'll give you his quote in just a second, looks to me like George W. Bush just lied to the American people. In Bush's speech yesterday, he said, and I quote, "The progress of the Iraqi forces is especially clear when the recent anti-terrorist operations in Tal Afar are compared with last year's assault in Fallujah. In Fallujah, the assault was led by 9 coalition battalions made up primarily of United States Army's Marines and Army, with 6 Iraqi battalions supporting them. This year in Tal Afar, it was a very different story," said George W. Bush. "The assault was primarily led by Iraqi security forces, 11 Iraqi battalions backed by 5 coalition battalions providing support." So that's what Bush said. Basically, the Iraqis are running the show now. They're taking over. We're just providing support services. But Michael Ware, a reporter for Time magazine, who was embedded with the U.S. troops in Iraq and the troops, the very troops who participated in the Tal Afar battle, appeared on Anderson Cooper yesterday on CNN, and he said that Bush's description was completely untrue. He said, and I quote, "I was in that battle from the very beginning to the very end. I was with Iraqi units right there on the front line as they were battling with Al-Qaeda. They were not leading. They were being led by the U.S. Green Beret Special Forces who were with them." Then Senator John Warner, the Republican for Virginia, who was also on the program with Anderson Cooper, is confronted with this testimony from Michael Ware, the embedded reporter from Time magazine, saying George W. Bush lied to us. Well, he didn't use those words. Those are my words, but pointing out the lie, shall we say. Anderson Cooper asked him about it, and Senator John Warner says, quote, "I respect those journalists that embed themselves, and I accept as a credible description what you've just put forward," end quote. Pretty amazing stuff. Pretty amazing stuff. Looks like one of my favorite conspiracy theories is falling apart, by the way. For years, an old friend of mine in New York City has held strong to the theory, which I hadn't been able to punch a hole in until now. So I couldn't argue with him that pigeons are actually spies from outer space. His proof for this is that you never see dead pigeons and you never see baby pigeons. And so he says, you know, pigeons, they're spies from outer space. The mothership comes down, drops them off, comes back in a month, picks up a million of them, drops off another million. They're little robots with little robotic cameras. And they go, and you can tell by the way they walk, and they go around recording everything that's going on with the human race. And this is why, in particular, whenever there's a meeting of, you know, like major world leaders, all the world leaders get together in Rome or something, there's millions of pigeons. Have you ever noticed? Wherever there's world leaders, there's pigeons. However, Wenatchee, Washington, Washington State, pigeons are falling dead from the skies over downtown Wenatchee. Was it the avian flu? No. Turns out that the state-licensed Yakima office of St. Paul, Minnesota lab-based Ecolab was hired to poison the birds. They call it an abatement. They killed off some of the birds, trying to tell the rest of the birds, you know, this is not a friendly place. James Rowe, the Humane Society, says there's no violation of the law. Although, if they didn't take out a city permit, they might have violated the city animal cruelty ordinance. In any case, the birds, a rain of dead pigeons out of the sky in Wenatchee, Washington. So much for my friend's theory, which I, you know, over the years, I'd been keeping an eye out on these pigeons. I guess they really are just birds. What can you say? So, a lot on our plate today. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And Sherwood in New York, New York on the line. Hey, Sherwood, welcome to the program.
How are you today?
I am just great, but I'll get better. What's up, Sherwood?
Well, you know, speaking of your conspiracy theories, this one's not about pigeons, but this one's about the story about the stories being planted in Iraq newspapers over in Iraq by the Pentagon.
Right.
And I did a little bit of research, and the Pentagon, for starters, it's not a little thing because they let out $300 million worth of contracts, $100 million to three different companies.
Right.
One of those companies happens to be the Lincoln Group. The Lincoln Group has a subsidiary called the Iraq X, which brags of its connections to this administration, certain select members of Congress, and the State Department.
Yeah, and this, and by the way, yeah, okay, keep on going.
Well, the long story short, and there's a lot of information that I won't go into, but I found this all sort of odd, to say the least. So I went to Lincoln Group and pulled up their board of directors.
Well,
one of the members is Christian Bailey, the same Christian Bailey that just conveniently happens to be or happened to have been the co-chair of the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Even more suspicious is the fact that the Lincoln Group, if you go back and look at when they were formed in 1999, claims their two purposes for being in existence were A, political campaign intelligence, and B, buying property in Iraq.
Yeah, and now they're paying to plant stories in Iraq on behalf of the military and on behalf of the basically I'd say on behalf of the GOP, because this has become a very political thing.
Well, exactly, and not only that, it's a little bit suspicious that Iraq X that was formed 2 years ago and the Lincoln Group that was formed in 1999 happens to have a co-chair of the National Republican Convention on their board of directors and comes from out of nowhere, much like the company that brought down Congressman Cunningham, and suddenly gets awarded a $100 million contract.
Yeah, and the company that brought down Cunningham, by the way, is also doing a lot of business with the White House that nobody has been looking into so far.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very curious about that.
That particular company, MCM, their first major contract was installing furniture in the Oval Office.
Right, and what's a defense contractor doing, installing furniture in the and providing intelligence services to the Oval Office, to the White House? It's a good one, Sherwood. I appreciate your calling and sharing it with us. A very good one. Bobby in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Bobby, welcome to the program.
Hi, I talked to you last week. I was the one who called about the Toyota.
I remember it well.
And I'm not trying to beat a dead horse because I do value your opinion. But I'm wondering, I mean, and putting aside the idea of a hybrid, because there's lots of people buying foreign cars that aren't hybrids. And, you know, if you did a comparison with hybrids versus gas mileage with small cars in the U.S., I don't know what it would be. But nevertheless, I'm wondering.
I can tell you what it is. As far as I can tell, there's no American manufacturer that produces a car that gets 55 miles to the gallon.
And that's
that'll hold five people.
And that's what your hybrid gets.
It does.
Okay, but there aren't that many people driving the hybrids. That's true.
Right.
I mean, certainly in some areas, I don't even know that, I don't know much about them.
Beyond that, I was speaking with a union leader here in Oregon a couple of days ago, and he said that basically there's only, if you want to buy a union-made car in the United States, there's only three cars that he could find that are entirely union-made, and two of them aren't U.S. companies. One of them is a Toyota Corolla, and he said there's only three serial numbers for that. The other is the Saturn, and the third one, I forget what it was, but it was not a U.S.-made car. But anyhow, your point had something to do with Walmart.
Well, yeah, my point was, that's information I'd like to have that you just gave me. However, my question is that when you do talk about Walmart, what's the difference between Walmart and buying Toyota? I mean, there is a built-in cost for labor and there's a built-in cost for benefits.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing with you. As I've said many times on this program, what Walmart is doing is legal, and that's the problem. We need to change the rules of the game rather than simply attacking the people who are playing the game by the rules. You know, Walmart can import all this cheap stuff from China, and Walmart can defy the Sherman Antitrust Act because the administration is choosing not to enforce it, and Congress isn't passing the laws that we need to go back to tariffs or to break up big corporations, or for that matter, to give communities the right to say, we'd like to have a certain quality of life in our community that has to do with keeping local retail. And again, you're not going to solve that problem by boycotting Walmart. You have to change the rules.
Okay, well, thank you, Matt.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bobby. I mean, this is just a fundamental thing. Shaming consumers is not a national industrial policy. We have to have appropriate policies. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There are people in this country who You work hard every day, not for fame or fortune do they strive.
Welcome back.
But the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay, and it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, indeed. Hello, Detroit auto workers. That's the bottom line. If we don't start changing our laws, if we don't start changing the way we interact with other governments, I mean, here we have, as I mentioned at the bottom of the hour, just 20 minutes ago or so, GM, which has just announced it's laying off 30,000 auto workers around the world, or in the industrialized world, basically, in the United States and in a couple of European countries, 25,000 here in the United States, is going on a hiring binge in India. Now, if we were to go back to a tariff policy and say, great, you want to import cars into the United States? Pay a tax on it. And if somebody wants to drive an imported car, they can pay that extra tariff. That's how we built this country. The tariffs actually funded our government right up until the Civil War. This is just the foundations of an industrial policy, saying there are some industries that it is worth keeping here. And you say, well, you can't do that. It's against the World Trade Organization. We can pull out of the World Trade Organization just as quickly as we pulled out of the Kyoto Accords. All it takes is the president saying, sorry, we're not part of that treaty anymore. Just as quickly as we pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty when George Bush became president. 1-866-440-THOM, our number, 1-866-440-8466. Rich in Stowe, Vermont. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thank you. Good to be here. Tom, I'll just give you a quick little update of what's happening here in Vermont with Walmart. In the fight to preserve communities in Vermont and to thwart Walmart, what towns are doing is they're trying to change the zoning and make sure that there's no stores allowed more than 50,000 square feet.
Right.
Walmart doesn't like stores that small.
Right, I understand. Here in Oregon, in fact, what they're doing is they're trying to use traffic abatement laws against Walmart. But here's the bizarre thing, Rich. The reason that they're having to use things like zoning to do this is because Walmart can claim that it's a person, and that if a community simply says they don't want them living there, that's the same thing as a white community saying they don't want African Americans moving in, and that's a violation of their 14th Amendment rights of equal protection under the law against discrimination. And, you know, tell me if that's not absurd.
It is. I wasn't aware of that. I think we're having some success with the zoning, though. I'm not really exactly sure right currently how good the zoning is doing, but, I mean, that's yeah. What's kind of...
No, it's a great start, and Vermont has been a real leader in that. I lived in Montpelier for 5 years, and in Montpelier, Vermont, the smallest state capital of the United States, the only one with no McDonald's, and virtually every restaurant in the city is locally owned, and the reason why is because we passed zoning ordinances in that city that said that if you want to have a restaurant in town, our definition of a restaurant, if you want to get a license to run one, is that you have table service and you bake your own bread on the premises. And all of a sudden, you know, there were a bunch of companies that didn't qualify, and like Burger King and whatnot and all that sort of thing. But at the same time, the city had to vote, you know, every other year or so to, you know, have another $50,000 in the city budget to pay the lawyers to fight the lawsuits from Walmart, from McDonald's. So, you know, the fundamental problem here, Rich, is that corporations have this extraordinary power because of corporate personhood. And if corporate personhood were done away with, then communities would be able to say, you know, this is the nature of the community we want. You would have, to use the example of Vermont, you have a county there in Vermont over by Burlington that said, we'd love to have big box retailers, and we would love to have subdivisions that all look like ticky-tacky and, you know, 500 homes on 100 acres, you know, or whatever it is. And they did. And now, you know, my experience living in Vermont was that a lot of folks are saying, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to end up like them, right? But they're having terrible problems as a consequence of it. But, you know, communities should be free to make those decisions. And the reality is that communities have not been free to make those decisions since the 1936 case of JCPenney versus the state of Florida, when the Supreme Court, when JCPenney sued Florida because they charged $25 annual tax to out-of-state corporations and only a $5 tax to local companies to encourage local companies. Now, it was $5 was big money back in the 1930s, or relatively speaking. But it was the principle. And the Supreme Court said, no, this is discrimination. And it's not discrimination. It's communities deciding how they want to be. And this it takes a fundamental revisiting of the law. I wrote a whole book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And these are the fundamental changes we have to make. Rich, thanks for the call and for the heads up.
You're welcome, Tom. Thanks.
And good luck with zoning. I mean, you know, it's like you use the tools you have, and I understand that. And just like, you know, in Oregon now, they're using traffic laws. They're saying, you know, well, you can only have a certain number of cars and a certain number of square miles, and you drop a Walmart in the middle of that, you start exceeding that, and we're not going to allow that to happen. But still, it's not a good thing. Stuart in Washington, in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Stuart, we have just a minute left. What's up?
Yes. You said that you did not support boycotts, that you felt that, Walmart was playing by the rules, but we shouldn't shame consumers.
Well, I didn't say exactly that. What I said is that I do support boycotts. In fact, I was a big supporter, for example, of the grape boycott with the union, you know, back 20 years ago.
Yes.
My point is that boycotts, by and large, are not as effective as changing the rules of the game, and that involves political action that goes way beyond boycotts.
You can't change the rules of the game when the people in power control all of the legislatures, and they've done it by hook or crook, but with these right-wing Republicans controlling the legislatures, we have to have a grassroots movement.
I agree, and waking up people is a part of that, and boycotts to a certain extent is part of the waking up process, because it's like street theater. But
yes.
But nobody should mistake that, you know, Walmart is going to change their policies because a bunch of people say, I'm not going to shop there because I don't like what they're doing. It's not going to happen.
Then we should drive them out of business.
Well, no, that what we should do is change the rules so that you have card checks so that people can unionize. You get a lot of Democrats elected, number one, and you start raising these issues and raising them relentlessly over and over and over again. Stuart, we have to wake people up. We have to educate people to the problems that this country is facing as a result of these conservative policies that have been embraced by Democrats like Bill Clinton, just like Republicans. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harkin.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The second hour of our program broadcast live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming across the Internet at airamericaradio.com, whiteRoseSociety.org, radiopower.org, CRN Digital. Congressman Ron Paul, Republican of Texas, is with us. Congressman Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I am very pleased to have you on the program. I have to tell you, first of all, although, you know, politically we're on opposite ends of the spectrum, Bernie Sanders, who's a dear friend and a regular on this program, speaks so highly of you on a regular basis. I don't know if you know that, but Peter DeFazio, who's a regular on my local program here in Portland, has also spoken very highly of you. You've got a lot of friends on the left.
Well, that's good to know, and they are good people, and I think when we honestly approach issues, sometimes we come together on these issues.
Well, and I think one of the things is that you're perceived as a guy who actually tells the truth, who tells it like it is. You don't play political games, you don't try and wiggle out of stuff, and you speak your mind, and even if somebody doesn't agree with what you're saying, at least they know where you stand, and I have to say, I respect that, and I know many of your colleagues do, so, all of that out of the way. I saw what prompted me to ask you to be on the program. There have been a number of times over the years I would have liked to have gotten your opinion on things, and hopefully we can have you back. But the thing that really caught my eye this last week was a series of media reports that suggested that you're suggesting that the Bush administration has plans in place or is initiating some sort of process that could lead to foreign troops enforcing martial law here in the United States. Can you explain that to me?
Well, you know, he's hinted to that on several occasions.
He being George Bush?
In emergencies. And Bush has, you know, first it's the 9/11 type of emergency, and then he hinted to the need for and the future plans to use troops on natural disasters. And also he talked about a martial law when it came to quarantines. You know, they're mm-hmm. involved now in medical protection, so in a suspension of the military inability to interfere in our affairs statewide.
Right, posse comitatus.
Posse comitatus. I think he's talked about this on numerous occasions, and I just don't like centralized big government, especially on the policing activities, which leads to a police state. So I'm very concerned about it.
Well, I'm right there with you in regard to the power of the state. We always have to remember and the warnings of our founders about, you know, the danger of the power of the state. The state is the only agency that has the legal authority to stick a gun in your face, as much as we may be concerned about corporate power. On the other hand, the state also has, in my opinion, at least some protective capacity, but that's not really what we're talking about here. This is, I agree with you, and I've been concerned about it, and I've reported on those cases when it looked like Bush was trying to roll back posse comitatus by fiat or trying to get around it, posse comitatus being the laws that were passed during the Reconstruction era in the 1870s in the United States after the Civil War that said basically never again, after we had this horrible Civil War, never again will federal troops be used, will be allowed to turn their guns on American citizens. We can have an army. We can have an army that goes outside the United States, but not inside the United States. But the word that hooked my attention was the word foreign. You were suggesting that Bush might be planning on using foreign troops in the United States.
Well, there's been hints of that. As a matter of fact, there's the claim that during the Katrina thing that there were some Mexican troops used in there to sort of set a precedent for policing activities. I can't absolutely verify that, but I've heard people talk about that. And he does believe in internationalism in that sense, you know, the international trade agreements, they could regulate trade. In the other areas, it wouldn't be a giant leap for them to start talking about the use of foreign troops. And we certainly have many examples of foreign troops being here, but it's always, you know, for training purposes. And I don't even like that. I mean, why do we have to be the training ground for militarism around the world? So it's not full-blown, and we don't see UN or foreign troops knocking on our doors, but I think we should think about this before it's too late.
But what was full-blown, we're speaking with Congressman Ron Paul, Republican of Texas, what was full-blown was that corporate agents were patrolling the streets of Louisiana, wearing, in some cases, guns that even U.S. troops are not allowed to carry. And, you know, these Blackwater, essentially mercenaries, these Blackwater and other private contractor companies who are so active in Iraq. I mean, the second largest army in Iraq right now is not the United Kingdom with 12,000 troops. It's the 20,000 private contractors over there. And these folks were patrolling the streets of Louisiana. Where do we draw the line? At what point do we say, listen, this is something only government can do, walking around with guns enforcing the law? I mean, how did we ever reach the point where private corporations who are not answerable to we the people can be doing this?
Well, it's a real shame, but that's the direction that we've been moving in. And I think, you know, the use of these private groups in Iraq sort of set the standard, and now they're hiring them out. And, you know, they're no-bid type contracts, and they just turn them over to their buddies. You know, I worry about big corporate power and big government power. But what we're dealing with, and this is, I think, where Bernie and I get along so well, is we don't like to see that combination where big corporations and government are in bed together. I mean, he and I would have disagreements on how to solve the problem of the poor, but we both see this problem with corporations getting the advantages and getting big contracts and making a lot of money, whether it's war at home or war overseas. We're sort of lost our government, and how we solve this problem, I don't know. Just, I guess, alerting the people, and hopefully they wake up. I always argue the case that local law enforcement should be a local affair, and that we shouldn't be making a police state. I mean, we have you know, along with the corporations that are carrying guns to enforce laws and interfere with our lives, there are over 80,000 federal officials who carry guns now too, and that's not the way it was meant to be.
No, who are not actually law enforcement officials.
No, I mean, these aren't, I mean, well, they consider themselves law enforcement. They're an agency. I mean, whether it's EPA or OSHA or Fish and Wildlife People or IRS agents, they're all carrying guns.
Why would an IRS agent carry a gun?
Well, because the IRS annoys a lot of people.
Oh, you mean for self-protection?
It's a dangerous job.
Yeah.
So they would say, well, they're doing it in self-defense, but it's also very, very intimidating, and maybe there's something wrong with the tax system if it's gotten to the point where our tax collectors are so frightened about a rebellion going on that they all have to be carrying guns. So it's... I believe in individuals owning guns, but I think we ought to have more gun control over some of these governments and not, like you suggest, the corporations now who are carrying the guns in the name of the government. This is a bit of an outrage.
Now, Congressman Ron Paul, you're a conservative Republican from a conservative state, a conservative district, and these positions that you're taking, frankly, to me, make a lot of sense. How is it? And they fly in the face of what I would say probably the majority of your Republican colleagues are out saying. How do you get along with your own party when you're saying these kind of things?
Well, the party structure and the party hierarchy, I don't get along with them very well. I had been in Congress and I was out for 12 years. And when I tried to go back in 96, the Republicans did everything conceivable to keep me from going back. But the grassroots, if I go directly to the grassroots and talk to them, it seems I can overcome what the leadership is saying. But there are days when I figure out I don't know how I survive, but I know what I have to do, and I just have to call it the way I see it and do my very best. And I think the fact that they know I'm trying to let them know exactly what's happening and telling the truth, they probably give me a little bit of a buy on that.
Yeah.
Because they believe I'm trying to do the best I can.
Yeah, cutting you some slack in that area. I find this fascinating. What can be done to stop the Bush administration from declaring martial law? I mean, what if there's another al-Qaeda attack in the United States and it just conveniently happens to be a month before the elections and Bush says, okay, that's it, no elections, martial law. What can we do?
Well, I'm afraid there's not going to be much immediately because they're marching forward on the attack on habeas corpus and secret prisons and all these things that they've attacked us since they passed the Patriot Act. But the only way it's going to be stopped is the people have to object. And Bernie and I, of course, have done a lot of work on the Patriot Act trying to wake people up. And that fight is still going on. But when the people object, they will get the Congress to object. And if the executive branch gets out of control, then we deny the funding. But that's where I'm not overly optimistic. I think our side of the argument is alive and well, and I think we have a pretty good coalition between right and left on some of these civil libertarian issues, which is very encouraging. But there are times when the executive branches totally ignore what we're trying to say.
And we need to awaken the people. Congressman Paul, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I so appreciate your being with us. Congressman Ron Paul, house.gov/Paul, the website. Thanks for being with us, sir, today.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Princess, honest people, and all the pretty people, they all drinking, thinking that they got it made. Exchanging all precious gifts, but you better take a diamond ring, you better pawn it, babe.
Yeah, because the Bush economic policies are going to wipe us out. Welcome back, my friends. Bob Dylan, man, I could listen to Bob Dylan for hours. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. The truth and common sense in broadcasting. Speaking from behind a good old working class stainless steel microphone. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi, I am in Washington, and a couple interesting things I want to comment on today. First of all, the last time I looked, I thought Scott McClellan was paid for by the U.S. taxpayers. But instead, I think the White House has gotten a little confused, and I think they may think they're the Republican National Committee.
How so?
Well, today, Scott McClellan at the Morning Gaggle was asked how the White House felt about these scandals with Duke Cunningham, et cetera. And, of course, there was a standard, you know, that the president abhors any illegal acts and blah, 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 blah. But then he says, well, then he was asked about, well, how do you think this is going to affect the 2006 elections? And he answers, in terms of the elections, the Republican Party is a party of ideas and a party with a clear vision. So far, all we see of the Democrats is what they are against. They are offering no vision and no ideas for the American people.
Let's see. Who's against Medicare, the Republicans? Who's against Social Security, the Republicans? Who's against, who's against unionization in the workplace? Who's against having tariffs that will protect domestic industry, the Republicans? On and on it goes. By the way, Ellen, did you see where Bill O'Reilly has now claimed personal responsibility for lowering gas prices in America?
No, I did not see that.
He says he has people inside the major oil companies, and he has, through his agents inside the major oil companies, managed to terrify the CEOs personally.
Oh, well, wow. You know,
I'm not kidding you.
As we say, sometimes people believe their own press release.
Yes.
The other thing that I want to talk about is the report today on the front page of the New York Times that the United States, well, basically now the White House says they're investigating this, reports the military paid press for favorable stories in Iraq. Now, first of all, I think the New York Times reports something like $5 million to this Lincoln company. I just want to tell you, my sources have that there is $5 million is a drop in the bucket to what the Defense Department is giving out in terms of the ability to influence U.S. policy. Now, again, I think I said to you yesterday, a lot of this should be State Department, but no, a lot of these contracts have gone through the Defense Department.
Right, and I would suggest that it's not just buying space in Iraqi newspapers. I'll bet when this, if anybody, you know, if the Democrats had power in either the House or Senate and could actually use the power of the subpoena and put people under oath, I suspect you will find that there have been stories placed in the media all over the world, including the United States of America.
You know, there's a couple of people who should remain nameless because I don't want to get a libel suit against me, who I am convinced work either for the Justice Department or the CIA and who write books, et cetera. There's just nothing in the world that can convince me otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, you know, supposedly this doesn't happen anymore in the good old USA, but I believe it certainly does. A couple other quick things, which is Congress now apparently is going to be taking up those presidential tax reform panels, and they are beginning to perhaps look at it. I don't know whether they're going to have full hearings next week, but you can certainly expect it into next year. And now Nancy Pelosi is calling for some fast troop withdrawal, but the Republicans are having a field day with it because they're going to try and paint her with the she's not patriotic stick.
I'm surprised they're not using the she's flip-flopping thing.
Well, you know, that you only want to bring that out on presidential elections because it's too powerful.
Yeah.
So you have to use other tactics in the in-between years.
She's not patriotic. Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable.
I mean, that is what people are like licking their chops in this town.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and Jack Murtha, you know, God bless him, he's out there holding his own. I mean, he was on Hardball yesterday, and he's doing the media circuit, and he's not refusing to do media, he is speaking out and speaking up, and there has been such an outpouring of support for him. I mean, we've tried to get through to his office for days, phone lines are just jammed.
One of the things that they are saying is, well, you know, he's wrong, that the people are very well armed now, our own military, the Iraqi military is being well armed. Yeah, that's why still a lot of them are going around in just plain white pickup trucks or small white cars, and we're running around in Bradleys.
I'm sorry, what do you mean? I missed.
In other words, they say that the Iraqi military is well armed, that we now
have
armed them, but still many of them are going around in unarmed vehicles while we're sitting our troops in Bradleys.
Yeah, and this is something that's actually causing a lot of distress for the American troops who are training these people, working side by side with them, and then watching them get blown up.
Exactly.
I mean, this is bad for morale.
It's true, I haven't been to Iraq in 9 months or 8 months, but I will tell you, it was, you know, it was that bad then. And it certainly has not automatically improved overnight, and particularly the reports we hear.
Any sense of whether Bush did himself a favor or whether he hurt himself with his speech yesterday?
Well, the White House said that, you know, that this was the president's position, and of course, one way or the other, they're not concerned. But the editorial boards of newspapers around the country have given it a thumbs down.
Fascinating. Ellen Ratner, thank you so much. Ellen Ratner with
the
Talk Radio News Service. Great talking with you, Ellen. It's 27 minutes past the hour here. Talk radio for the rest of us in the Tom Hartmann radio program. Yes, that's me. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
There once was a musical troupe, a pickin' singin' folk group. They sang the mountain ballads and the folk songs of our land. They were long on musical ability, folks thought they would go far, but political incompatibility led to their downfall.
Uh-oh.
Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear was a Methodist.
Hey, welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartmann here with you. Amazing. Jeremy Scahill is with us. He's with The Nation, a writer for his most recent article, thenation.com, by the way, the website. Beyond that memo, Bush wanted Al Jazeera gone. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Tell us about this. The story that everybody knows, and I suspect for anybody who hasn't seen the movie The Control Room, basically the only story that they know probably is that the British press had a day of hysteria last week when the story was leaked that there was a memo that Tony Blair talked down George Bush about bombing the headquarters of Al Jazeera. And now, you know, the story is out there that Bush was just making a joke and Blair was just making a joke. But the guys who apparently released this information are being prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. But, you know, it hasn't really gone anywhere in the American press. What's the story behind the story here, Jeremy?
Well, first of all, George Bush wasn't joking or laughing at the time he allegedly made that comment to Tony Blair. Now, I have to say at the onset, we have no idea what Bush actually said. But what we do know is that the White House has not come out and said it's not true. The White House has called it outlandish. They called it unfathomable. Neither of those words mean untrue. And they've been very careful in how they've dealt with this. The British government has called it a conspiracy theory, and they've also been very careful. And the fact of the matter is that this could have been swept under the rug very quickly, even without the compliant corporate media, but for the actions of the British Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, who very quickly after this report came out in the Daily Mirror, which is a big tabloid in Britain, he threatened to prosecute any media organization that published any portion of the memo, indicating to a lot of people that there actually was something to this story. But if we back up from this memo for a second, Tom, and we just look at the context of what was happening when Bush is alleged to have made this comment to Tony Blair about bombing Al Jazeera's headquarters in Qatar. It was in April of 2004. It was on April 16th. In the 2 weeks preceding that meeting that Bush and Blair had, the United States was engaged in an extremely bloody battle in Fallujah. It was the original siege of Fallujah in which 30 U.S. Marines died, some 600 Iraqi civilians. Inside of the city of Fallujah was one network. That network was Al Jazeera. Their correspondent, Ahmed Mansour, was reporting on the fact that the United States was targeting and killing civilians and reporting on the piles of decaying bodies that were in the middle of Fallujah streets. And at one point, Ahmed Mansour, this Al Jazeera correspondent inside the city of Fallujah, said, "Last night we were targeted," and I'm quoting here, "last night we were targeted by some tanks twice, but we escaped. The U.S. wants us out of Fallujah, but we will stay." Well, on April 9th...
Us being Al Jazeera.
Ahmed Mansour was the reporter for Al Jazeera. He was inside of the city of Fallujah,
right,
that the United States was trying to take. He was doing two things. One, he was reporting that it was a lie, that the United States was not targeting and killing civilians. But number two, he was also saying that the resistance inside the city was, number one, a domestic local resistance, not foreign fighters, but number two, was achieving significant guerrilla victory in repelling the U.S. Attempts to take the city. And so the United States very frantically wanted Al Jazeera expelled. And so on April 9th of 2004, the United States made a condition of a ceasefire that Al Jazeera leave the city. Well, Al Jazeera, being the independent journalist that they are, refused that. And then according to Ahmed Mansour, and this is going to be coming out in a new article that I have in The Nation tonight, the very next day, American fighter jets bombed the house that Al Jazeera had been using to broadcast from the night earlier. So on April 9, 2004, we had yet another attack, according to Al Jazeera, on an institution that they were using.
And another attempt to assassinate an Al Jazeera reporter.
Well, I mean, you could read that way. I mean, it certainly seems odd that the United States would do a surgical strike on a home that Al Jazeera was broadcasting from. And the great tragedy there is that it wasn't just the home that was destroyed. The owner of the house, a man named Hussein Samir, was killed during that bombing. And so then by April 11th, it was a full-out war against Al Jazeera on television with the U.S. military spokesperson saying they're not a legitimate news source, Mark Kimmett, saying that propaganda and lies. On April 15th, Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon called Al Jazeera vicious, inaccurate, and inexcusable. It's disgraceful what that station is doing. And it was the very next day that President Bush met with Blair and allegedly told him that he wanted to bomb Al Jazeera's headquarters.
So this is an entirely credible report.
Well, I think that I don't know is the short answer to that.
Given the context, if any discussion happened, I guess the credible part of it would be that it wasn't a joke that Bush was making.
I think that, a Newsweek last night had a very good report on this written by Michael Isikoff, where they quote yet another British official as saying that Blair did not think Bush was joking at the time, and that Blair actually did have to step in and try to talk him down off of it.
Right.
Whether or not it was a joke, we won't know. And if it was a joke, it's not only a disgusting and tasteless joke, but it's one that's not at all far-fetched. The United States bombed Al Jazeera's headquarters in November of 2001 in Kabul, Afghanistan. They bombed their headquarters in Baghdad on April 8, 2003, killing correspondent Tariq Ayub. They bombed, they shelled the hotel in Basra in early April 2003. The only guests in the Sheraton Hotel at the time were the Al Jazeera reporters. Al Jazeera reporters have been imprisoned by the U.S. forces. Some of them say they've been tortured. There's a cameraman being held at Guantanamo, and he's being constantly interrogated about Al Jazeera's connections, alleged connections to Al-Qaeda.
At this moment?
At this moment, yes. He's been his lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, says that he's been interrogated 130 times. Out of those 130 times, he's been interrogated 100 times about Al Jazeera connections, allegedly, to Al-Qaeda. And, in fact, he was questioned specifically about the Al Jazeera correspondent who was in Fallujah, Ahmed Mansour, this man who I'm reporting claims that an Al Jazeera home was bombed inside of the city during that siege. So
right.
You asked me whether or not this report is credible. We won't know until a British publication or another publication publishes this memo or the relevant parts of this memo and defies the Official Secrets Act. I've been calling for a Three Musketeers approach to this, where you would have All for One and all of the British media outlets simultaneously publish it as an act of defiance against this attempt at censorship in Britain. The Nation magazine is going to also be calling for people to leak the memo to it. And that they'll publish portions of that memo as well, and that'll be coming out tonight. So we don't know until it's published whether or not Bush was serious, what the context was, what exactly was there. But the fact of the matter is that we don't need that memo to say that the United States war against Al Jazeera and other unembedded independent journalists must stop now. No more journalists killed in Iraq. 80, Tom, media workers have been killed since the United States.
This is more than in all of the Vietnam War, as I recall.
66 journalists were allegedly killed during the Vietnam War. We've got 58 journalists who've been killed in Iraq, and then the rest of that 80 number is translators, fixers, and drivers. So we've had a total of 80 media workers killed In Iraq, 13 reporters documented to have been killed by the United States, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. It has to
stop. In some way, we're speaking with Jeremy Scahill. He's a reporter for The Nation, thenation.com, the website. His new article, Beyond the Memo, Bush Wanted Al Jazeera Gone, and there'll be a new one tonight. Check out thenation.com for that. In some ways, Jeremy, this is emblematic of a larger war. Perhaps, you know, we should use the word metaphorically, but a larger war on the media that the Bush administration has been waging from day one, buying off journalists, planting phony stories, just the very simple and obvious thing of any correspondent who dares to ask George, you know, King George, a question that he doesn't like Helen Thomas, gets sent to the back of the room and is never called on again. And for somebody who has spent their entire life working their way up to the point in their career where they're a White House correspondent and they're finally making, you know, six-figure salary and doing well, to have George Bush say, sorry, you'll never be called on again, is literally the end of their career. I mean, they're terrorizing journalists inside the White House. It's a little different than shooting at them, but I mean, this is an administration that has been at war with the press virtually from day one, is it not?
Well, they have smeared and maligned Helen Thomas, implying that she somehow is supportive of terrorism.
Oh, and their shill Ann Coulter calling her that old Arab because she's of Lebanese ancestry. I mean, it's incredible.
But I mean, the fact of the matter is that since they launched their so-called war on terror, this administration has waged an undeclared war against independent journalists who refuse to get in bed with the military. And the fact of the matter is that Victoria Clark, the Pentagon spokesperson at the time, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, sent a very clear message on international television to the unembedded journalists who were in Baghdad. She said, "You should not be there." That's an exact quote. That was chilling, given the fact that it was only a few days later that the United States shelled the Palestine Hotel, killing Jose Cuso, a cameraman for Telecinco in Spain, and a Ukrainian cameraman who worked for Reuters, and they killed Tariq Ayoub, the Al Jazeera correspondent.
As you can see in the movie Control Room, and we should let our listeners know, Victoria Clark was the official spokeswoman for the Pentagon at the time.
Yes, and but the fact of the matter is that, you know, Bill Clinton bombed a television station in Serbia in April of 1999, and he killed 16 media workers, and we had to fight the Committee to Protect Journalists to count them in their list of killed media workers that year. So it's bipartisan. I mean, the Democrats also were horrible in targeting journalists that they considered to be enemies, but this administration has taken it to new heights, and they have not masked for one minute their disdain for the independent press. And quite frankly, I have no doubt in my mind, and some people may think this is too radical, but I think that the United States has targeted journalists in Iraq.
Yeah. And it has to come to an end. We've been talking with Jeremy Scahill, thenation.com, the website. Check it out.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There's a warm tonight and the moon turns the tide. When the stars take their ride, she'll be leaving.
Welcome back.
I don't know. She won't tell me what it is.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back, my friends. One of the folks in the chat room here, Buster. Tom, all through history, it's proven if media and others do not challenge ruling governments, governments will go corrupt. Amen. Amen. Absolutely well said. By the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, just go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It will get you there. Speaking of propaganda, you know, there's all this music now out there. It's not just the stories that are being placed in the newspaper. It's all this
Bush was right. Bush was right. Bush was right. Bush was right.
Yes, indeed. It's all that kind of stuff. And now we find, for example, these are boom times for right-wing rock, and not just because the Wright Brothers hit single Bush Was Right now has a music video. Another educational conservative band, Junkyard Prophet, has been touring high schools across the country, but these rockers aren't sticking it to the man. They're being funded by him. The band apparently receives $1,500 per appearance, an amount that several schools have paid out of their drug-free schools funding from the U.S. Department of Education. Your federal tax dollars at work. CampusProgress.org has the details. The Des Moines Register reported that after one 2004 performance, Junkyard Prophet handed out CDs to a few random students that bore this message: the death sentence is on you due to your sins. The very evidence of your sin will be your death. It is appointed to you to die, and after that you will be judged according to your ways. His judgment is so thorough, every thought will be brought to light. When all your sin against God is exposed, how can you escape the damnation of hell? End quote. Yes, your tax dollars paying for this. Dean, Prophet's frontman Bradley Dean, has also told students that there is not, quote, there is nothing in our Constitution or founding documents about separation of church and state, end quote, and criticized the theory of evolution. Now, I'm sorry, the last time I read the Constitution, there is this thing in there that says that there shall be no religious test for any member of the judiciary, and that the federal government shall not establish an official church. According to the band's website, it's appeared at over 220 schools over the last few years. In some instances turned up by CampusProgress.org, students were told that attendance at the assembly was mandatory and they would be suspended if they skipped out. The rise of right-wing rock and roll rolling across America, some of it with your tax dollars and mine. Good old Crazy Zell, he was right. Don't you get it? He was right. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Craig in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Craig, welcome to the program.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I just wanted to comment on a couple of things. A guy that was in the military, a retired gentleman, told me about, well, he said worldwide that the United States was 24th in freedom of the press, and I haven't checked out the site. He said it was on freedomhouse.com. I don't know how credible that is, Tom, but
it may well be. Freedom House, by the way, is the chairman of their board of directors is Jim Woolsey, who's a right-wing neocon, but Freedom House was founded by Eleanor Roosevelt. And,
oh, is that right?
Yeah, and was involved in the overthrow of the phony governments in the Ukraine, in Belarus, in Serbia, and in Soviet Georgia.
Well, that seems pretty far. 24 seems pretty far down there, Tom, considering,
yep,
you know, this is, freedom of speech, First Amendment, freedom of the press,
yeah,
which is a First Amendment, actually, here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, I can't speak for whether Freedom House has that exact statistic, but there certainly are a lot of sites out there, and there's a lot of evidence that, you know, and Ben Bagdikian's work on the media is probably the best, The Media Monopoly and The New Media Monopoly are his books, where basically what they're suggesting is that we don't have freedom of speech in the United States by and large because of corporate control of the media,
right,
because of corporate consolidation of the media, because the Sherman Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act, is not being enforced as it appropriately should. And
sure,
frankly, I think if the Sherman Act was enforced, that you'd actually have a more profitable media in the United States. Just like when AT&T got broken up, but you know, by Jimmy Carter using the Sherman Act, you had actually shareholder equity went up. People who owned stock in the parent company ended up owning stock in a whole bunch of smaller companies that became more valuable.
And I think what you said was right before I came on, and that is, if the media doesn't basically confront the government, that it becomes corrupt.
Right. And
there's things wrong. But one other thing I wanted to talk about and get your comments on this was the former CIA director, George Tenet. I think Bush set him up to be the fall guy in the 9/11 and also the Iraq War, so he could bring in his buddy, his friend,
Porter Goss,
who, of course, retired Admiral Stansfield Turner, who was the DCI in the late 1970s, he called Porter Goss's nomination a bad day for the CIA. He said that this was the worst appointment that's ever been made to the CIA.
Well, and he wasn't the only one. I absolutely agree with you, and frankly, I suspect that one of the reasons why they kept on why they kept Tenet on was because he was a Clinton appointee, and therefore they could say, see what Clinton did?
Yeah, he's a Bush loyalist.
Yeah, yeah, but they could always say...
Trick.
Right, but they could always say, "Yeah, it was Bill Clinton who appointed this guy. It's all his fault," and you know, which is one of the Republican mantras. So who knows? Craig, thanks for the call, though. Great
sure.
to hear from you. I appreciate it. And it's just, this is the way these guys do this stuff. And I'm surprised, frankly, that George Tenet hasn't been speaking out the way that some of the other folks who've left this administration, Colin Powell's right hand man, for example, calling Dick Cheney names. It's just Christy Todd Whitman. I mean, the list just goes on and on. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Clara Jeffrey is with us. She's a writer with Mother Jones. She's actually the deputy editor of Mother Jones magazine, MotherJones.com, the website. Clara, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have a great article, Are Americans Charitable or Chintzy, in the November-December issue of Mother Jones. Just share with us a few of the stats that you start this out with, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, I think the one that most alarmed us here, most amused us as well, was that Americans spend $8 billion on Christmas decorations, and that's almost four times what they give to protect animals and the environment.
That's eight times what we gave to help Katrina victims.
Exactly. And it's I think it's something on the order of twice as much as our government gives to aid to Africa.
Now, the flip side of that is, who should deny Americans Christmas decorations?
It's true. But $8 billion? It just seems a little excessive.
Either that's excessive or the amount of our charitable giving in relation to that seems chintzy. Cheap.
That's right. I mean, Americans, what's interesting is that two in three American households say they give to charity, and kind of a lot. They say they give about $1,200 a year. But only one in three households actually reports charitable deductions to the IRS. Now, maybe some people wouldn't qualify for a deduction.
Yeah, I would guess. I have to say, I have very often not reported charitable deductions that I've done. Because I haven't, because if you don't itemize and you don't itemize in particular ways, you can't take those deductions.
That's right. If they're being accurate, Americans do give a fair amount a year. What's interesting is that as a percentage of income donated to charity by income bracket, the poor give more than the rich. And what's also interesting, we have a nice little chart on this page that people can look at in the magazine, is that after the tax breaks, which by and large went to the wealthy, their donations to charity went down, while donations from the poor, who really weren't a beneficiary of those tax cuts, has been steadily increasing.
Fascinating. Now, you also note, 4 years after George W. Bush founded the Millennium Challenge Corporation to reward Africa's best-run companies and pledged to fund it with $5 billion a year, only 1% of that amount has been dispersed?
That's right. And in fact, it would have been a far lower percentage. The MCC finally gave its first disbursement right as we were coming out with this. They've basically given no money. And that's, one of the typical dodges of the Bush administration and previous administrations as well, is to make a big pledge, but then as the years go forward, is that pledge fulfilled?
Well, he flew over to Africa and made that big hoop-de-doop about we're going to give $5 or $15 billion. Was that this, or was that?
That was this. This was a program designed to sort of reward countries that were doing better in terms of corruption or other, you know, problems afflicting those countries. And certainly many countries have done better, and they still haven't gotten the money. When he was pressed about this and asked about doubling African aid in the wake of the Darfur famine crisis, Bush said that it, quote, doesn't fit our budgetary process.
Yeah, which brings us then to the, really what I think is the larger issue and the debate that I think that we should be having in the United States, Clara Jeffrey, with MotherJones.com, Mother Jones Magazine. And that is, where should private charity end and the commons, which is administered by all of us and is part of, you know, what we pick up as, you know, government functions, begin? For example, back in 1978, my wife Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire. It's still there, the New England Salem Children's Village. And the state, you know, paid for most of the kids' expenses, but wouldn't pay for things like Christmas parties. So, you know, we would do fundraisers. We did a lot of fundraising, actually. That was my main job. Louise was running the program, and I was out raising money. And it seems like there should be, there are some things that we just shouldn't have an argument about. You know, this shouldn't be the province of private charity. This should be, you know, this should be something where we collectively say, you know, we're going to care for the least among us. We're going to do that. And then there are some things on the flip side of this. I remember when I was a reporter back in the 70s, back in Lansing, Michigan, interviewing Mayor Jerry Graves, the mayor of Lansing at that time, who had just spent $250,000, which is a lot of money in 1975, on what looked like a giant baseball mitt, this piece of art to be out in front of City Hall. And I was interviewing him. I said, you know, Mayor Graves, what does this art represent? And he pulls his cigar out of his mouth and he says, oh, you know, infinity, something like that. I don't know. And that was his response. You know, the bottom line was that he had the money. He was spending the money on something, you know, that was essentially self-aggrandizement. And it turned out later, you know, the contract went to somebody who was connected to his campaign. And, you know, probably that was money that, or arguably that was money that we the people shouldn't have been spending, or at least should have had some say in. And whereas I can tell you that in 1975, there were families in Lansing, Michigan who were hungry and they were not getting money from the city. So shouldn't we, rather than just be talking about, you know, Americans are chintzy or Americans are generous, shouldn't we be talking about where do we draw the lines between what's appropriate for the government to be doing with tax dollars that, after all, are taken by force? I mean, the conservatives are right about that, versus those things that would be nice, but it's really not part of the commons, and it's the appropriate province of charity.
Well, I mean, I think we saw, you know, quite vividly during the Katrina crisis that that government spending that everyone agrees should have happened, that, you know, government management, that charity in an emergency situation, and in fact just having those people be better prepared before the hurricane came is absolutely necessary. I also think Americans think we spend way more on charity and the poor, both home and abroad, than they do. For example, Americans think that 24% of the federal budget goes to foreign aid, and as you know, in a matter of fact, it's less than 1%. So, you know, I think people think, oh, that's where my tax dollars go. It goes to help these people, and maybe it goes to, you know, some bad public art on behalf of a mayor's ego project. But, you know, most of it just does not go to the poor, does not go to things like the environment. And while I think there's definitely a role for private charities and foundations, I mean, the baseline is, you're right. I mean, the things that are in the commons, we all need to take responsibility for.
The founders, when they put together the Constitution, and for that matter, the Declaration, it was the Declaration of Independence is the first founding document of a nation in the history of the world, of what we call civilization anyway, that had the word happiness in it. You know, there's this concept that the commons, that you know, what Abraham Maslow would have defined as the bottom part of his hierarchy of human needs, you know, safety, security, food, shelter, just these basic things actually are the responsibility at some level, not just of individuals, but of society as a whole. And then, you know, you go up the ladder, up the pyramid, and you get into the higher, you know, things, and those are might more appropriately be the province of private charity. Shouldn't we be, in our discussions of charity, more pointing out that there are still among us hungry, that there's some 20 million families in the United States who experience food insecurity or hunger throughout the course of a year, that there's 45 million people without health insurance, that those people are the victims of Katrina, that none of that should have to turn to private charity, that this is stuff that at its core should be the responsibility of all of us, and that on the other hand, there's a lot of things that are appropriate for private charity.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think also the thing about private charity is that because they're private, they get to pick and choose what they give to and what causes they support, you know, as they should. But that doesn't do the sort of baseline job of protecting those most vulnerable in our society necessarily. And I think, you know, the reason to do it for people who hate being taxed is that unhappy people tend to sooner or later
overthrow
their governments. Yeah,
fight back. Yeah. You end up with crime. You end up with disease. You end up with societal problems that don't give you the kind of country you want to live in.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a thought-provoking article. Clara Jeffrey, the deputy editor of Mother Jones Magazine, motherjones.com. And overall, Clara, would you say Americans are generous?
I think they're not doing the job that they think they are. I think they come through in a crisis, and I think we saw that with Katrina and with some of the other major emergencies, that individual giving. But I think people have to realize that to be really generous, we have to do these common efforts, and that's done through taxation and a centralized government plan.
Right, and the assault on that and on government with Reagan with his limousine welfare queens, which turned out never to have existed,
right.
Has really created a toxic atmosphere around doing what you're talking about.
And I hope Katrina has started to change that.
I hope so, too. Although, you know, we're hearing the right wing already talking about, well, these people were poor, it was their own fault, you know, blah-de-blah, it's already started. Clara Jeffrey, you can read the article, motherjones.com, or pick up the magazine.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run, Father, when the fast bullets fly.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, if you'd like to call. Drop into our live chat room. Find out what that's all about. No, it's not that kind of chat room. This is a really cool one. Some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. Go to TomHartman.com and just click live chat. 22 minutes past the hour. The place where you can receive your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Pamela in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Pamela, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Pamela.
And it's hard to come off of that last discussion, but I want to go back to the media, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And something I'm very curious to know if you ever saw this. I only remember seeing one article in the New York Times about it, but it was when I was in graduate school, 586. It was the year of Rangate, and Reagan's administration was actively supporting the Afghan rebels. I believe they were the Taliban at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't the Taliban, it was the Mujahideen. Yeah.
And when they were fighting...
Which was Osama bin Laden, by the way.
Exactly. And we were referring... Reagan would refer to them as like our founding fathers when they were fighting their Afghan government and the Soviets there. And at the time, there was an article came up about the Afghan Video Project, and this is when Boston University was taking in Afghan rebels to teach them how to do videos and then sending them back into the fields of Afghanistan where they filmed video of the different things that were going on during the war and then sending them back to our news departments. And those stories were being included in the nightly news.
Right, those being, by and large, things like Soviet atrocities and battles with Soviet forces.
Right. So you remember hearing about this. I've never been able to find anything in print since then, but it's so typical. I think people have to think about all the different forms of propaganda. We, of course, now have had this happen. We know from Susan Faludi's fine work about the fact that we've also had companies that do their own press releases to news departments and make it sound like it's a news story. You know, the latest and greatest in
cosmetics. Yeah, that's been going on forever.
I mean, right, in cosmetics. And this is all propaganda. And when I was in graduate school, we studied white, black, and gray propaganda. And I think the obviously now we've come through the Fox News kinds of blitz, and people in this country are much more aware of how it is that we get mind, you know, effed all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a real problem, Pamela, and you appropriately bring it up. It's and thank you for doing so. This we really need to be paying attention to this, and the this whole issue of the Bush administration out there buying through private companies. There's a little secret hook in here. This whole issue of the Bush administration buying press in Iraq and in the United States through private companies is a really significant one. And the hook is that private companies are not accountable to you and me. Private companies don't have to play by the rules of the game that you and I have to play by. They don't have to follow the same rules. They're not stuck with the same laws. And therefore, you know, because they're unaccountable, because they can maintain their Fourth Amendment rights of privacy, in many cases we never find out. We never get to know what actually happened, what's really going on with these organizations. And that's one of the reasons why the Bush administration is outsourcing so much stuff, is to keep it secret. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I wanted to make a comment about that mandatory Bush was right song, but I'll wait and make sure I have enough time.
That actually was not the song that was mandatory. It was another group that was mandatory. That I didn't have mandatory group's music, but the Bush is right. It's a whole genre of music right now, of right-wing music, that is doing very, very well, in part because it's being funded by the Bush administration.
Well, it's a stylistic rip-off of Green Day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded just like them, and Green Day is brilliant. But I'll call Amanda on that later if we have time. Early in your show, you discussed homeschoolers from Patrick Henry College.
I mentioned Patrick Henry College was started in the year 2000 to take in children who had been in Christian homeschool programs.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'd like to let your listeners know, you did not imply this, and I did not infer, but that not all homeschoolers are the same.
We homeschooled one of our three kids.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, and there's a homeschooling section on my message board. I ran the homeschooling forum on CompuServe for 10 years.
Oh,
and if you go to TomHartman.com and you go to our message board, there's a whole area for homeschoolers there. I am entirely in favor of homeschooling.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
I did my first son, but I am my second.
Yeah, no, we after homeschooling our third, we looked back, Louise and I looked back and said, you know, how could we have put our first two kids through that, through public schools?
My progressive homeschool group that meets once a week is the opposite of those kinds of homeschoolers that would end up in Patrick Henry.
Yeah.
For instance, as a social studies class, the parents and the kids read My Ishmael, whereas students who end up at Patrick Henry College, to me, they cling to the biblical creation myth so as to make all the earth under the dominion of Christendom. One of many examples of takers is Daniel Quinn described.
There you go. Yeah, absolutely, Bonnie. Absolutely. And in fact, they would not have been allowed to read My Ishmael because it would have been considered demonic or satanic or something like that, because it's not, not only is it not Christian, it is essentially animist. I mean, Ishmael is the paean to animism. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Thanks, Bonnie, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I went down to the store. I got some brand new shoes. I told him, make the leather tough. I gotta walk the blues. Walking the blues. I'm walking the blues all day.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour.
I'm out my shoes, but I'm walking the blues away.
Walking the blues. Welcome back. There you go, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Just in the news, South Africa's High Court ruled today it is unconstitutional to bar gay marriage, paving the way for that country to become the first in Africa to legalize homosexual unions. Gay rights activists welcomed the ruling on a continent where homosexuality remains largely taboo. In its ruling, the court gave the country's parliament a year to change the legal definition of marriage to include same-sex couples. So this is great. South Africa recognized the rights of gay people in the Constitution adopted after apartheid ended in 1994, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Married couples have numerous rights still denied gay couples, including the ability to make decisions on each other's behalf in medical emergencies and inheritance rights if a partner dies without a will. And so the Supreme Court of South Africa is saying, can't do that. I don't know how many countries that makes now, but it's a whole bunch of them. You know, it's going to be legalized in England here coming up in the next couple of months. Elton John getting married, a whole bunch of other folks. So in the meantime, just another little interesting tidbit here. Venezuelans, this from Cat Lestrange via, from BBC actually, via Mark Crispin Miller, newsbbc.co. Venezuelans are going to vote for an expanded 167-seat Congress. Two seats have been added since the last election. So currently, supporters of President Hugo Chavez hold 52% of the seats and hope to increase their majority to about two-thirds. There's going to be 120,000 soldiers watching the polling stations, and the poll will be overseen by the Organization of American States and the European Union. However, there is a boycott happening. A fourth Venezuelan opposition party has now withdrawn from this Sunday's congressional election amid a dispute over electronic voting machines. Now, David, is that the company in Venezuela or the company in the United States?
Venezuela.
In Venezuela. Okay, can you find the name of the one in the United States? One of the four largest voting machine companies in the United States is actually owned by Venezuelans, and I am forgetting the name of it. But the company in Venezuela is Bista Corporation. And the Venezuelans are worried about electronic voting machines. Primero Justica's decision means that more than half the opposition groups have now pulled out of the election. Why? Because they're concerned that Chavez could rig the vote using electronic voting machines. Electoral officials deny such accusations, say voting for the expanded 167-seat Congress will go ahead as planned. The government of Hugo Chavez has vowed to increase its majority to two-thirds, which would allow it to pass constitutional reforms that opposition leaders strongly oppose. Three other opposition parties pulled out of the poll earlier this week, accusing the electoral body of favoring pro-government candidates. The Democratic Action Project, the Project Venezuela, and the Social Christian Party. Chavez hit back, claiming the opposition was trying to derail the election and accusing them of plotting with the U.S. to destabilize the country. President Chavez's backers have called a rally on Thursday in support of the congressional election. Washington, D.C., said it is increasingly concerned about the state of Venezuela's democracy, but denies helping the opposition parties. This is amazing. The Bush administration is saying that they're concerned about the electronic voting machines in Venezuela. Democratic Action Leader, this is one of the anti-Chavez parties inside Venezuela, Henry Ramos, has called for a suspension of the election until equal conditions existed for the parties. He told reporters earlier this week there were software irregularities in the national voting machines. Mr. Ramos also cited lack of access to official voting lists and deep mistrust of the National Voting Council, the CNE, most of whose members are in the ruling party. Representatives of the Electoral Council have repeatedly denied accusations of pro-government bias. The authorities had removed fingerprint machines at polling stations after opposition leaders said the identification system threatened voter confidentiality. But that didn't please the opposition parties. Greg Morsbach, the BBC correspondent in Caracas, says that despite the boycott, a number of opposition parties are still committed to taking part. He adds that divisions within the opposition are likely to continue. The vote on the poll on Sunday will be overseen by observers from the Organization of American States and the European Union. So here's the incredible irony. The United States, our government's position is we're worried about the integrity of the electronic voting machines in Venezuela, that those electronic voting machines might be being used to rig an election in favor of Hugo Chavez. And yet, Sequoia Voting Systems, a voting machine company that has supplied a lot of voting machines in the United States, I believe that they are the largest supplier of voting machines for counting the vote here in Oregon. Yes, we have vote by mail, but still the ballots are fed through machine counters. I may be wrong, but Sequoia, not a small company, a major player in the voting machine business in the United States, is actually owned by three Venezuelans, one of whom was denied entry into the United States recently because he was a security risk. Now, you know, go figure. So here we have the United States government saying, you know, we don't trust those electronic voting machines in Venezuela because Hugo Chavez is running them, but we really like the voting machines here in America, even though some of them are owned by Venezuelan companies. I mean, it's like, have we fallen down through the rabbit hole? Where's Alice? 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Nick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, if anybody can be considered an expert on stealing elections, it would be the Bush administration.
Yeah, I would say, and they're looking at electronic voting machines in Venezuela going, doesn't sound like a good idea. Maybe we should pay attention to them.
Yeah, I think we should. By the way, George Bush Jr.'s big speech yesterday,
yeah,
I have to say that was a big joke. I mean, there was nothing new in it. There was no plan for any kind of victory. There's no definition of what victory in Iraq meant. It's just the same old warmed-over propaganda that keeps serving to us, hoping that we're going to buy it someday. Well, guess what? You know, the Bush administration has no credibility, and the American people aren't buying anything they say at all anymore.
By and large? Yeah, you're right, Nick, by and large. It's amazing. You know, I'm on all the lists as a talk show host. I'm on all the right-wing lists, everybody's list, you know, for all this stuff. And I get all these talking points from the right wing about, you know, right on down to the stuff. I mean, they're still trotting this thing out about, we did find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, they've got a list of things that they say, you know, we found this and we found look at all this uranium we found. Well, as a matter of fact, actually, the UN had that under seal, you know, and we, like, found it because we knew it was there all along, and Saddam acknowledged it was there. It wasn't radioactive. It was yellow cake. I mean, it was radioactive. It wasn't fissionable. Couldn't be used to make a bomb. And we let the locals loot it. And, you know, for example, I mean, you know, but it's like I get all this right-wing stuff, and they're all, you know, trumpeting the great triumph of the Bush speech and all the right-wing talking points to go along with it. It's just, it's amazing. But you get increasingly, or I get anyway, increasingly the sense that they're flailing about. That they just don't have, they don't have the sense of self-confidence that they once had. Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and thank you for listening. Don in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hey, Don, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I just calling about your discussion with the individual from the Ayn Rand Foundation.
Right.
Earlier today.
You're on Brooke, yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, if corporations want to be able to call themselves persons, people, they have to abide by regulations themselves. You know, laws. Say, for instance, we wouldn't let a person go ahead and commit murder, and the only deterrent would be you have to, you know, if they get the court case afterwards and go into prison, you know, we have a deterrent, the police force. And I'm just thinking.
Well, it goes beyond that. We actually exercise the death penalty against human beings in the United States for murder. There have been corporations that have been convicted of at least manslaughter. One of the most prominent cases is in my book on equal protection. There's a meatpacking company in the Midwest that their detectors for salmonella and other bacteria that can kill people started just going off the scale. And so, and because what had happened was the air conditioning equipment, which they had just replaced above the meat line, was dripping bacteria-laden water down onto the meat as it was being packaged into packs to go off to the stores. And when their detectors started going nuts and saying, look at all this bacteria, they turned them off. And it was many deaths later that the USDA was able to use DNA testing to figure out that all these different people around the country who were dying from eating this particular type of meat, I think it was over 100 people, these hot dogs, that they were all getting them from this one, it had to be one particular type of bacteria, and they tracked it back by finding that bacteria in a package of hot dogs that was half eaten in the freezer of somebody who died from it. And this company got basically a slap on the wrist. This happened during the Reagan administration, and Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush even came out and gave a speech about how noble the company was. And I mean, they had done everything they could to cover this thing up. I mean, it was just, it's incredible. And so, yeah, the idea that corporations are persons, not people, but persons, is a bizarre notion, and yet it's the law right now, Don.
Yeah, that's my whole point, is if you know, they want to be able to call corporations persons, then shouldn't they also have to accept the regulations?
Right. They should have gotten the death penalty. That corporation should have gotten the death penalty. It should have been dissolved.
Yeah,
and the death penalty, dissolving corporations, was something that was actually very common in the United States from 1787 right up through the end of the Civil War, or right up through the years of the Civil War. And then it pretty much stopped after Lincoln's assassination. And the reason why, of course, is the Civil War allowed, first of all, caused Lincoln to break a bunch of, you know, change a bunch of rules and allowed the corporations to just get way too big. Don, I'll give you a little more rant on that when we come back. I appreciate the call, and thanks for bringing up the topic. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean vote.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't throw your head in the sand. You got to fight for your rights. You can't just bury your head in the sand.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. Now you got to get out there and speak up, speak out, participate. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Got an email. We were talking about post-traumatic stress disorder on the program the other day, and you know perhaps as many as a third of the soldiers, perhaps more, frankly, of the soldiers coming back from Iraq will be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. This is a serious and real psychological injury that for some folks can last for a lifetime. I mean, there are treatments. Probably the most effective is EMDR, eye motion desensitization and reintegration. But it doesn't always work, and there is serious problems with PTSD. And the federal government now is saying we want to revisit this. We've got some 70,000 GIs who are on disability because of post-traumatic stress disorder. They're looking at possibly hundreds of thousands coming down the road. And so they're doing a reevaluation. They're reevaluating what the criteria are. They're asking all these people to prove that they actually are experiencing from this. I mean, it's horrible. And for example, and you know, we, as I said, we had this conversation earlier in the week or late last week, I don't recall, and got this email. Hi, my name is, we'll leave the name out. And a little over a year and a half ago, my boyfriend was severely injured when an IED ripped through his Humvee and threw it into the air. While on a night mission outside Camp Taji in Iraq, he suffered a spinal cord injury and L1 through L3 burst fractures, as well as nerve damage in his left leg, and both of his heels and ankles were shattered, while his right foot was very mangled and ripped open from the blast. He's undergone many surgeries since his return back to the States, and recently he just had his right leg amputated below the knee. He was in too much pain to keep it. It's one of the hardest decisions someone could make. Since he's been back and trying to recover, we've been through so much. From the birth of our son and his mother's unfortunate suicide to the military screwing us over and acting like they don't want to help us. The past 2 years have been a roller coaster of less than desirable events and a lot of stress and unnecessary bullying by the military. They are going out of their way to make sure that he doesn't get the proper pay and back pay promotions and financial help. He can't work, obviously, and I'm taking care of two children and him. The military must be crazy or not care. I'm on my last ounce of tolerance here, and it's so sad that there are worse situations than ours. I think the nation should know that, sure, we support our troops in every aspect. While the president might be wrong sometimes, but it's the individual units and military officers in their leather chairs sitting back, having everything they need, who are making it impossible to survive after returning home from war. I really think if you talk to Bill, my boyfriend, you and everyone in America can begin to understand that it's not so much the PTSD making it hard to live, but the crap around them that makes the PTSD difficult to tolerate. It has hit my family hard. The outbursts and the mood swings and the nightmares and the flashbacks, the sudden jolts of anxiety and adrenaline pulsing through their veins when they hear a loud noise or someone bumps into them or when a car comes to a sudden stop, having to deal with anger and tension and depression and loneliness. Being on the receiving end of PTSD is almost as bad as having it. You become a target, a release of tension for them. almost as if you are the one who is responsible. It's not easy living with someone like that. Hopefully it gets easier. Time will tell. If you'd like a first-hand account of what's happened, then Bill said he would gladly participate, but only under the assumption his words be told accurately and truthfully. The media couldn't possibly understand what that means. I mean, a name withheld for obvious reasons. This is a tragedy, and I'm telling you, the Bush administration is getting ready to not just getting ready, they're already doing it, to absolutely leave these vets out in the cold. Just leave them out in the cold. Say, sorry, it's a mental illness. It doesn't count. Post-traumatic stress disorder is real. I'm sorry. It's absolutely real. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. It's appreciated.
Sure.
I want your opinion on this. I believe Republicans, they're trying to build their majority. Where strict Catholics and evangelicals were at odds with one another for a long time.
Mm-hmm. We
probably still are.
We being, in your family, or you mean in the Republican Party?
No, the Republican Party.
Okay. Right.
I think they've been trying this slowly, and they did. They succeeded a lot. Build their majority by bringing strict Catholics and evangelicals once at odds with each other.
Right.
On what they call the culture of life issues.
Right. Basically abortion.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not really culture of life, because what you find is that Catholics are opposed to the death penalty, and many evangelicals are not.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a very big cleavage there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, they play this card all the time, obviously. That's a given. And one more thing, if I may say this. This is very common sense to me. They have the Republican, not all of them, but most. There are a few good Republicans out there. It's too bad it's not
the
majority.
There's quite a few good Republicans out there, Gary. I keep asking them to please take back their party.
I know it. You've been right all along. You've been leading the chart. You've been right so long. I think their conscience is bothering them a lot.
Clearly starting to. I mean, you've got Larry Wilkerson out there, Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who spent 16 years at the right-hand man of Colin Powell, a Republican, all his life.
Yeah.
He was the number two guy, the assistant to the number one, to the Secretary of State, out there referring to Dick Cheney, the vice president, as a bastard. I mean, we're talking about not just a level of guilt. We're talking about a level of rage here that the Republican Party is starting to experience from its people.
I learned something when you said that.
It's very, very real. Gary, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. This is just, pushing right up against the edge. And this is part of, I think, the implosion, the not even coming implosion, the current. It's imploding, the Republican Party. And, hopefully rational folks will take it back. I would love to see the Republican Party once again the party of Eisenhower and the party of rationality, and the Democratic Party becoming once again the party of Roosevelt. And let's get back to the old discussions we used to have, about just straightforward stuff. How many roads are we going to have? How many bridges are we going to build? What kind of national industrial policy are we going to have? How are we going to make sure people have jobs? We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.